Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan. This week, Alyssa Mastromonaco and I discuss the most Devon of news cycles and chat with NARAL President Elise Hoge about Ohio's magical new law and what is to be done when we live in a snow globe of tears and lies. Then Megan Gailey, Naomi Akparagan, and Grace Parra join in studio to talk about the pressure to be happy, what it means to be depressed, and crying about macaroni with too much cheese in it. Then, as always, our hills. A quick note, this week we talk about depression, mental health, and the effect that substances have on those things. If you're struggling with these issues, here are a couple of places that can help. The National Hotline for Mental and or Substance Abuse Disorders can be reached at 1-800-662-4357. That's 1-800-662-HELP. And the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. Now let's get to the show. The news is, once again, a conveyor belt of mass-produced chocolates, and we are the overwhelmed candy inspectors just trying to keep up with all of it. From impeachment drama playing like a TV you can't turn off to the latest in the never-ending race for the Democratic nomination, it's tough to keep up with it. So I'm going to call up former White House Deputy Chief of Operations under President Obama and the Ethel to my Lucy, Alyssa Mastromonaco.
Hello.
Hey, Alyssa.
Hello, Erin.
So I have a question.
I'm ready for it.
This is a question that it actually has something to do with the news. It's not a stupid, it's not stupid. What did Devin Nunes think was going to happen?
I mean, it is stupid. What did he think was going to happen?
I mean, now it's every time I look at footage from, you know, the impeachment hearings that happened, you know, a million years ago or last week, you see his face. And now I just hear the Curb Your Enthusiasm music playing. What was he thinking when he was up there? You know
what I was thinking about? It's like all those times in life, say, I don't know, you're a senior in high school and you go four wheeling with your friends and wine coolers in the rain and you get stuck and have to call the police to come get you. And then your parents show up in the rain under an umbrella and they basically call you the stupidest person alive. What did you think was going to happen when you went four wheeling with wine coolers? That's what Devin Nunes did. With OMB and some fucking Russians.
And I want to sit him down and be like, okay, Devin, can I call you Devin? Devin, Devin sounds like an adjective for the very Devin way he behaved. I want to be like, okay, walk me through what you thought was going to happen here. Did you think you were going to get away with it? Did you think that you were going to, nobody was ever going to find out? I mean, I guess maybe he is going to get away with it, right?
You know what I want? No, you know what I want? I want the next time your beloved Queen Eleanor eats a plant and then throws up from it, I want you to be like, that was so Devin.
And also, what kind of a monster makes so many telephone calls? These people who are involved in this Ukraine scandal, they talk on the phone entirely too much, a monstrous amount.
Literally, have you ever talked to, if you looked at your outgoing call log, have you called your entire call log as many times as Devin Nunes called Rudy or OMB or anything like that?
No, I do not call my mother as much as Devin Nunes calls Rudy Giuliani. And I mean, I don't call very many people very often, but like, Jesus Christ. Want to move on to another quick story.
Yeah, of course.
RIP Kamala Harris's campaign. Pouring
RIP.
Pouring one out. What did you make of the news that she was not going to be running for president anymore?
You know, I was bummed out. I think that she is great on the debate stage. And I actually think of all the people running, she would have had a really good chance against Trump specifically on the debate stage. But like, money's money. If you don't have the money to keep your campaign going, there's not a lot you can do. And it sounds like there were internal campaign issues that greatly contributed to this. But, you know, I liked having her voice in the race.
Yeah, I did appreciate though. I also think we need her in the Senate though. I think she's a very good senator. She's great on the Judiciary Committee, and she also had a pretty good clap back to the president yesterday when he tried his like little syrupy sarcasm from NATO. Which, yeah, of course you have time to tweet it from NATO. Go ahead, dude.
To tweet while you're shunned by all world leaders.
Everything is going so smoothly there. You better take it to Twitter. But she responded that she would see him at his trial, which is the case since the Senate will be the jurors when the president is impeached. And he is probably, you know, I'd bet some money that he's going to be impeached. No.
I mean, he'll be impeached, right?
Like, I mean, he'll be impeached. After all that Devin behavior from the people that
so
he's
Devin.
Just, so fucking
so
Devin.
Devin.
Alyssa, did you see in any coverage of Kamala Harris, like sexism and racism? Because I saw some people kind of reflecting on her dropping out of the race. And, you know, you can't really be a black woman running for office without having that be something that people consider in the way that they treat you. Did you notice any of that?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, we've talked about it. It's look, it's like even when I saw this really fucking annoying thing yesterday afternoon, a reporter on television who said, this is so bad. He said, you know, one common theme here, Kirsten Gillibrand's out, Kamala Harris is out. The two people who, you know, actively took it to Joe Biden, proof that if you're going to go after the king, you better not miss. Are you fucking kidding me? Like, that was the dumbest take I've ever heard.
Yeah.
That, like, if you're a woman and you're going to go after Joe Biden, you better be ready.
Yeah.
I mean, no, of course. And it's like, but also yesterday the thing that was, I think, most infuriating is that all of these reporters who had not been especially charitable to her all these months were talking about her dropping out and not even referencing the fact that she's a black woman, right? That it made it harder, that there were more barriers, there were more hurdles. They were just like, oh yeah, like she, you know, didn't make it, but she was a great candidate. Well, you could have said that when she was actually a candidate.
Yeah, she was a boundary breaker, and that's something that you shouldn't gloss over at all. Yeah, we definitely haven't seen the last of Kamala Harris. It's not like she's, you know, going to the land where the sun never sets in from like the Hobbit land or whatever. I don't know. She's like going to be around, and we're going to see more of her, and she might even run for president again someday, which would be cool.
I mean, she's pretty fucking young.
She is pretty fucking young. Good for her. Alyssa, this week I was, you know, impeachment stuff. It's happening. It keeps happening and I can't keep up with it. So I was trying to take a break and I ended up going down an abortion K-hole, as one does. And I realized that there's a ton of stuff happening when it comes to reproductive rights and that I have been very bad at keeping up with it. But because I'm so overwhelmed, Alyssa, do you think that this would be a good time to call in some reinforcements?
How about Elise Hoag, president of NARAL?
I love hearing from her. Let's talk to her. Let's call her.
Send out the bat signal.
Okay. The Elise Hoag bat signal. Hello, Elise.
Hi, Erin. How are you?
M'lady, it's Alyssa.
Oh, my goodness. Hi, Alyssa.
We have some questions. And
okay.
We hope you have some answers because this is a world of confusion that we're living in.
I definitely have some theories.
Okay, good. Theories work. Okay. First off, thank you so much for joining us. My first question for you is, you know, you're quoted in a New York Times piece that ran recently about the fracturing in the pro abortion access movement. And I want to know what you made of the piece as a whole, and specifically what you made of the really cocky quotes from anti-abortion advocates about the movement destroying itself.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that there are some questions that we should examine in the piece about what's the state of access and how do we best assure that all providers who do create access across the country have the resources that are required for them to serve all of their patients. And I think that's all great. I think that, you know, I wrote this on Twitter. I think it's like kind of annoying when they get into the like, oh my God, look, not everybody gets along, which is true of life and true of all movements. And you muddle forward. And in fact, this is a movement that has worked very well together for a long time, but movements are messy. Mm-hmm. And I think they glossed over and in fact, completely let the anti-choice movement off the hook by treating them as honest brokers, which they are very much not. And, you know, the paragraph that I was really drawn to was partly the sort of gloating tone of Penny Nance, who runs, quote, Concerned Women of America. Certainly they're feeling kind of crowy and gloaty, which is really overambitious of them. And we can talk about that in a minute. But there was a whole paragraph about their strategy for 2020, which they're putting $41 million behind, which literally amounts to targeting key demographics who will vote in 2020, particularly women, particularly soft partisan and independent women who started to shift in the Trump era, and telling them lies about abortion to get them to stop defecting from the party. And, you know, what's fascinating to me about this is sometimes we sort of fall into the trap of treating disinformation as something that only happened with Trump or only happened with technology. But what I always say is the anti-choice movement were early adopters in analog disinformation, right? And then we just called it lying. And the part of the way that they have made such progress when their agenda itself is deeply unpopular is by telling lies, which are actually quite dangerous because a lot of them are about medical information where we most need the truth about what's happening. And this 2020 election strategy is absolutely no different. And that's the piece we should all be paying attention to, is how do we actually secure abortion access for every person in this country that needs it by beating back a dishonest, cheating, and lying anti-choice movement?
Mm-hmm. Elise, how can Democrats refocus the abortion discussion in a way that can help us win in 2020? And also, this is just a bit of a rant, but is there any way for us to stop unfit judges like this dipshit Sarah Pitlick, who has a zero rating from the ABA, thinks IVF creates inferior children and is generally not a good person, from being voted on and likely confirmed by the Senate today, Wednesday, to a lifetime appointment as a judge in the U.S. District Court of Eastern Missouri?
Oh, my goodness, Alyssa, there is so much in that question.
I know. So that's why I went second.
Let me take the second part first, because obviously I've been engaged in a lot of conversation about this charming woman today. But, you know, one of the things that I find is that people are shocked that she would actually voice her anti-IVF opinions. And I have to remind people that this is a really consistent ideology for anti-choice people, right? It is. I wrote on Twitter last night that, their basic theory is women are put on this earth to do one thing. And if we choose not to, we're suspect. And if we can't, we're failures. And all of us deserve our fate. That is a very consistent foundation among anti-choice advocates. And how does that translate? It translates from all the way from no accurate sex education, to no contraception, to no abortion, to no IVF, to no surrogacy, to no stem cell research, into criminalization of pregnancy laws that we've seen start to happen. And that's because they are really, you know, they really are not about abortion, or I should say they're definitely not only about abortion. What they are about is enforcing a rigid picture definition of what family should look like, and using everything in their power through policy, through the judicial realm, to enforce that. And it's deeply undemocratic, and it actually looks nothing like America. And so that pivots to your second question, Alyssa, which is their entire strategy of disinformation and putting more of these right-wing nut jobs on the bench relies on our silence. It relies on Democrats specifically, but certainly movements, right, to actually not only not call them on their bluff, but also not be willing to lean into our advantage in 2020, which is that lots of people have had it with their shit. Am I allowed to say shit on the show?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
You're actually penalized for not saying shit on the show. So thank you for doing it at this point. We were going to have to kick you off for not saying
shit. I'll try and get in my quota. You know, this is the sort of old mantra, right, of the things you talk about and the things you don't talk about, and identity politics don't win elections. Well, identity politics, as everyone on this show knows, is simply the word for when your concerns, your intersecting concerns of who you are, your economic security, your professional prospects don't look like those in power, which are traditionally cis white Christian men, right? So, like, actually, when we look at the data, vast majorities of Americans not actually only support abortion access, but are scared of what's happening. It's a vote driver for them. For the first time in 2018, we saw more people saying they voted Democratic because they were worried not just about abortion, but that was a huge vote driver, but about what's happening at the courts, which goes to your second question, Alyssa. So we can't fight yesterday's war. We have to operate in the real politics of today and start to lean into these issues and the values that they represent, right? There's a reason we fight for abortion access. It's about human dignity, compassion, and the freedom to live our own lives. The other side, they're not really for that. So when Democrats and movements lean into that and draw a stark contrast, they're not only calling them on their bullshit, number two, of the lies and disinformation, but they're actually winning the war of the hearts and minds of most of the American people. And we've got to get that happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, as you were talking, Elise, I was thinking about how, you know, Penny Nance and Concerned Women for America are going after, with a lot of money, these kind of like upper class white women who have defected from the Republican Party because they're kind of grossed out by President Trump. But it seems like going after IVF is a real bad way to appeal to upper class white women, since IVF is something that a lot of them deal with. So I don't know. I was just thinking that is a really crazy confluence of strategies. Speaking of crazy, I'm sure you've talked a lot about what's happening in Ohio, where lawmakers are trying to require doctors to implant ectopic pregnancies back into wombs. Why are they getting more brazen, despite the fact that, like you said, there are more people who really strongly support abortion rights? Why are they doing this? Like, what is the end game of making up a magical procedure and then trying to punish doctors for not being able to do it?
Yeah, let's start with the basic facts, which that idea that you can re-implant an ectopic pregnancy is medical disinformation. My doctor friends say that's not medicine, that's magic. It can't be done. And it's easy to laugh at it, but in fact, doctors who would be forced to try to do that actually endanger women's lives. And you know, that's why there's been such a backlash. But, you know, good public policy that's grounded in facts and science and addresses human need is not these people's goals. These people's goals is, you know, these people's goal is to enact a very rigid ideological extreme agenda through state legislatures, through the judiciary. And they're really emboldened by the Trump era because there have been not a lot of checks and balances on it, right? You have to remember this has been a 40-year strategy for them. And this is a good part that the Times piece got right. When you don't hold popular opinion, as you point out, this is not popular opinion, how do you win? You win by, I hate to use the word rigging because it's become such a bad word, but rigging the system. So, you know, when they recognize that they don't hold popular opinion, they took over state legislatures, and they do it by hiding their real agenda, right? Because it's not popular. And then they gerrymander, and then they pass voter suppression laws, and they use disinformation. And because that has been such a winning strategy for them, and look, we're also complicit because we've let them do that in silence for too long. And sunlight is the best disinfectant. now in the Trump era, they're extremely emboldened. And one of the most significant cultural shifts we've seen in the Trump era is that if you look at sort of the decade that preceded it, the anti-choice movement led by, of course, Penny Nance and Marjorie Dannenfelser from Susan B. Anthony list, who were quoted in the article, but your very own Kelly Conway, who was sort of the godmother of a lot of these communication strategies, they really recognized that they had to sort of cast women as victims, right? We're sort of like not very bright and clearly confused, and therefore were subject to manipulation. And no woman in her right mind would ever terminate a pregnancy if she wasn't confused. And that led to all these laws like waiting periods and forced ultrasounds. But what's happened in the Trump era that I find the most fascinating and undertold, underreported story is because Trump is Trump, right? And because he surrounds himself with people who are like him, just overt misogynists, the anti-choice movement has actually felt liberated to shift that from women being victims to women being perpetrators. We are now just straight up perpetrators, and we're seeing that play out in all of this punitive legislation that's passing in so many red states, whether it's the forced pregnancy bills in Georgia and Alabama that carry, you know, jail sentences, or my home state of Texas, where they actually held a hearing supporting the death penalty for women who seek abortion. But all of these criminalization of pregnancy laws, like the case of Marsha Jones, who was shot in the stomach while pregnant and was jailed for it.
So, Elise, everyone on Twitter knows that I refer to you as my commander in chief. So as my commander in chief, what
that
are
was
some
a nice
actions?
Touch. Thank you.
What are some actions that regular people can take to keep these stories in the headlines?
It's the basics, right? And it's just that we have not enacted the basics at broad scale on the issue of abortion as it's related to misogyny, as it's related to punishing women. So it means talk about it. It means demand that your media talk about it and talk about it in ways that actually exposes what the other side does. It means asking any candidate who is seeking your vote for any public office, from, you know, I hate to use the cliche dog catcher all the way to president, to actually talk about what they will do, what is their position, what are their values, and to call out the other side. It's writing letters to the editor. It's showing up for hearings. They depend on our silence to win, and we have actually given them that gift for a very long time. I think, you know, not just women across the country, but the progressive movement and the Democratic Party and the candidates are waking up to not just the real threat, but the opportunity of actually just embracing this mantle of freedom and equity and equality for women. But we need more of it. And we need to do it by modeling it to everybody. We expect to do the same.
Okay, so noted, being a pain in the ass is once again the solution to our problem. I've gotten a long way by being a pain in the ass, and I would encourage everybody listening to also be a pain in the ass, especially about this issue. Elise Hogue, thank you so much for joining us. We have to have you on again. This was really, really great.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
To hear from you.
Thank you guys both for all you do. I adore your show and I adore both of you.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Elise.
Talk soon.
Bye.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, a panel joins me to discuss depression. And welcome back. I'm no longer alone at this lonely table. Thank God. And I have three women with me that I'm so excited. This is a group that has not convened in quite some time.
I don't know if
maybe ever.
Maybe this ever. Exact combination, never?
I don't think
what?
So.
What? I don't feel, think so. Wow. Yeah. Very special. Okay. First, I want to introduce, she's a comedian and she's furious. It's Megan Gailey.
Oh, wow. I honestly didn't know it was going to be me because I'm like, I feel like Naomi's a little furious.
Well, that's my natural
but
way.
But it's me. Hello. I'm too, yeah.
It's like, well, it's raining in Los Angeles and everybody's grouchy because all wimps about the weather now. My succulent's most grouchy of all. Like, you know, if you put like water on a succulent, it's like, no, don't touch me. They're so mad and I'm not bringing them inside because they have to learn how to deal with it.
They're outside.
Up next, we have the host of the Couples Therapy podcast, which you can see live this Saturday if you're lucky enough to be in cranky Los Angeles. Yeah. It's Naomi Ekperigin.
Yes, and you have to come to the show because Saturday is my birthday, so if you don't, I will take it personally. I will consider it a personal attack if no one appears. I'm very anxious about this. This is like the worst of both worlds for me. To have like a birthday and a show and be like, do people like me?
So, well, you'll find out.
Well, this will be the test.
You'll find out.
It's a funny lineup.
I try my best.
Former panelist Kara Klank is on
Indeed.
Deborah DiGiovanni.
You know it.
I memorized. I told you I have nothing good going on.
Deborah DiGiovanni opened for you that one time I saw you at Dynasty.
Yes, she's a tour de force.
So funny.
Tour de force.
She's so funny.
Her visa just got extended. She will be staying in America 10 more years.
Thank God.
Thank goodness.
We need
I know
it.
A lot today.
She's angry, but knowledgeable.
Furious and educated.
And that husky voice you hear.
Oh, so husky.
Back from a long-ass break because she had, I'm making sarcastic air quotes, because of her job.
What's a job? I don't know.
It's Grace Parra.
Hi, guys.
Welcome back. It's been a long time. And congrats on getting engaged.
Thank you.
Congrats on being hysteria poisoned.
I can't believe, I don't know what's in the water here, but it truly is affecting all of
us. We're all getting engaged.
We truly are.
I also need the listeners to know, you guys, again, as Aaron said, it is raining in Los Angeles. It is a torrent, okay? Grace Parra has come through with a full 40s curl and wave. She's giving you Grace Kelly Latina realness.
And a shift. I show up for my women.
I'm wearing a Target sweater. And the fact that you came through with a curl.
You
I
know
can't.
What I will say? This dress is from fashionnova.com, which I think I love.
I love
that shit. I love it. So $20. $20.
She loves it. She loves her fast fashion.
I always thought it was a scam. I was like, that can't be right.
It can be a scam, but you gotta sift through it.
Awesome.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to get into a topic today that is like not happy. So but I think it's probably good to approach it when you're in a good mindset. And that is sadness/depression and the way that the holidays sometimes feels like it brings it out. Because this is the time of the year when everyone is supposed to be happy, but also you're kind of like forced to party a lot, which is like something, if you're not feeling good, it's like the worst thing in the world is going to a party. Second worst thing in the world is drinking alcohol, which is a depressant, but you're caught. Like, it's a real perfect storm.
Yeah.
I personally cried over a casserole of mac and cheese because I thought there was too much cheese in it before I put it in the oven on Thanksgiving. So that's where I'm at mentally.
Yeah.
I want to start with you, Grace, because it's been a while.
It's been a while.
What is it about? Do you ever get sad around the holidays?
I definitely do. A lot of it is nostalgia. A lot of it is the pressure to feel like you have to be happy around this time. I think that there is a difference between clinical depression and between holiday sadness, for sure. I think those things can become intertwined sometimes when we talk about it, but they are very separate. Holiday sadness, though, I think affects more people generally. And I think, like I said, I think nostalgia is a big part of it. There's a kind of sentiment that is inescapable. I was at Trader Joe's last night and I walked into fucking
inescapable
Winter
Trader.
Wonderland. Yes, inescapable. And I just couldn't believe, like, if I wasn't feeling particularly chipper at that moment, I was okay at that time, whatever, just trying to get some fucking grapefruit. I don't know. and I walk in and it's just everywhere. Every image that you're seeing, the music that you're hearing, the ads are all being targeted towards this cheerful time of year. And if you're not feeling that, it just doesn't, it's really hard to escape it. It's really hard. Radio, same thing. 103.5 here in Los Angeles is now playing Christmas music all the time.
All I Want for Christmas Is You came on yesterday in the car and I said, oh no, it's begun.
It's begun.
I forgot for a minute. Even though, of course, we're in the beginning of December. What did I expect?
Yeah.
But it's like you hear those tones and it's almost to me like a horror sting.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Yes.
You know? Sorry. Continue, Grace. Tell your story.
That's the story. It's inescapable for me. It's hard this time of year for sure. And everybody else is feeling emotional too. And my mom met my my fiance's family for the first time over Thanksgiving. And it was lovely, but it was a lot seeing the families come together for the first time. Mm-hmm. And now his family is flying to meet my entire family over Christmas. Mm-hmm. So whatever we experience over Thanksgiving is going to be like with all the siblings now, and it's like going to be, you know, 20 times over. So it's wonderful. It's emotional. It's a lot. I don't know how to deal with it though. That's the one thing. I'm sort of just taking it one day at a time. I'm sure there are guidelines. Do you guys have advice? What do you do?
God, I went on NPR once and was the advice giver how to handle holiday stress. And the last time I saw my parents, my dad called me a bitch. So on the way to my own bridal shower, he goes, you know what? You're a real bitch. And I was like, pick me up at Saks. I suffer from depression.
Do you?
I do. I was diagnosed. I've been in therapy since I was 12.
Okay.
I actually started seeing a counselor who had treated my brothers for sort of behavioral issues. And then he'd been like, I can't handle you. I think I've talked about this before. And then I had to go see a woman who specialized in female adolescence and was with her until they had to kick me out.
So last week.
Yeah. I know, I've been on Lexapro since I was 16, on and off, and it really, really helps me. And I think the holidays in particular, I was at home. I was here in Los Angeles over Thanksgiving, and I ended up getting the flu. And so all I could do was lay in bed while my whole family was together. Mm-hmm. And whether you're estranged from your family or not, not being able to be geographically close to them is hard. And sometimes being geographically close to them is difficult. As CJ kept reminding me, if I had been with them, I would have been upset too. And so there is all that pressure. And then I think the holidays adds in financial stress too, of people want and you feel the need to give things to your loved ones, because that is like the signal of love at this time, whether it is or not. And you're just required to give so much of yourself during this time. And it's very draining. I think it reminds us of people we've lost, that we cannot be with. Mm-hmm. The closest loved one I've ever lost died 5 days before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And so I think about her even more as the anniversary of her death comes up. And and you just, you're never going to have a perfect holiday, but the pressure to portray this perfect holiday because of social media, I think, has been just added in past years. And it's very much okay to go, this sucks, and I'm actually really not handling this well, and I need to do what I need to do, and that may be sitting out giving gifts for a year. And people are not understanding of that sometimes, but they should be, and if they're not, then they can really fuck off.
I mean, you bring something up that's really interesting, because all of us, none of us are from the city where we currently live. And I think in a lot of cases, if you're somebody that's pursued a career where, like, the hub of that career is not where you happened to be born, then you end up living a life where you're not close physically with your family. And for me, I think the last time I lived, I was 18. I moved out of the house. I just turned 18, went to college, and I've not been within, like, a 5-hour drive of home ever since. And, like, my brother and my sister both live close to my parents and like their family, they all hang out. Sometimes when I go home, I'm like, I get this feeling like you guys have all been hanging out without me. You're all hanging out without me so much. And then I start feeling bad because it's like, what is the solution here? Like, were they supposed to like fly to Los Angeles every time they were going to have a hang? Like there's just no, we all chose to be separate from our families. And I think sometimes that contributes to a feeling of like aloneness and isolation, even though like everyone is portraying togetherness. It's sort of like you can't really feel together if you've been, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles away from somebody for a really long time. Naomi, I wonder if you experience any sadness that fluctuates with in relation to the holidays and how you handle it.
Well, you know, I have, for me, a big part of it too, it's not only, because it's funny, I feel this in LA, and you know, everyone knows I don't like it here, but for instance, there are a couple things that happen, and for some reason this year really hit me, daylight savings hit me hard.
I think the sun has been
and that's
hiding.
A big thing to me, and I think for instance, when it's raining, like I get extra angry. I usually love rain, but there's something for me where, to me, LA's only saving grace is sunshine, and once you take that away, then I'm just in a wet suburb, and so I get real extra like, I don't like this, but it's also... I think a big part of it is like, it's dark now. Literally, you got like 5 good hours to do stuff. And then it's dark and that feeling. And then also a big part of it is just, you know, as I already said, like my birthday, but all of this stuff for me, like I think of December, it's like the year in review. So I think the big part of it too is like looking back on the last 11 months being like, hey, well, what did I do? What happened? Was it good? Do I have a resolution now? You know what I mean? Like to be like, what's going to happen in the new year and stuff.
That affects me so much. It's like being on the precipice of a new year and feeling like, well, this year's got to be the best year ever. How am I going to make it the best year ever? Mm-hmm. There's an added pressure, not only to feel like you're wrapping up the year, but that you are amping up to have the best year ever. Whatever you do, make sure that it's the best year ever. And we have no control over those things.
Yeah.
But we feel like we have to set ourselves up for that kind of expectation, and it's impossible to live up to. It's almost like the Sunday scaries, but December is a month-long Sunday scaries.
A full Sunday scaries. And like what you were saying though before, where you're like, how do I deal with family and stuff? My big thing, which I feel like we have to do more of, especially as you were saying, Megan, like you give and give, we have to be comfortable stepping away from everybody, because it's not simply to be around family, but it's to be around family 24/7 and these big group gatherings. And, you know, sometimes Andy and I will just like go get breakfast somewhere else, like just go leave the house, let my mother trip over the right plate and then come back when she's solved that problem. You know what I mean? And it's like, and I think sometimes it's like, we're together now. We need to be together. And it's like, absolutely not. Think about anybody you love the most. Can you really talk to them for more than 90 minutes straight?
No.
So it's like, we all need to like take a very quick break during all of this. And then you can kind of like get your energy back up to be like, tell me that story again, auntie. You know?
I'm someone whose happiness is sometimes tied to how I'm feeling physically. And I do think this is a time when we are like stuffing ourselves.
Oh, that's
literally
yes, Megan,
with
yes.
stuffing. And in the Sunday scaries vein, we're like, listen, Monday I'm getting a salad, so I'm tripling down. And we're just gorging because we know come January 1st this is done. And then we're feeling bad about ourselves because we physically don't fit in our clothes. We're drinking, we're smoking weed, we're doing all of these things that are just making us feel ill inside and angry with ourselves.
You know what I tried doing the other day? And this actually made me feel, because I've been on a, like everybody goes through ups and downs or whatever, but I've been on a like down. And that's okay. I mean, whatever. Everybody goes through them. But I was, I woke up very, very early, like to do a yoga class.
What time do you usually wake up?
Like 7:30, 7:38.
And so very early was
I woke up at 5:20.
Wow.
And went to yoga at 6. And like when we came out, and I went with Josh, and we came out, the sun was like just up, and I was like, whoa, daylight. Like, so I got the whole day of daylight. And
love that.
I hate like, you know, waking up early, you're just like, I don't like this. But then once you're up, it's sort of like that day I was like, oh, this is great. I'm perking up. It felt really good to just like get out of bed early. Now, when it's cold, I mean, In a warm climate, that's easy. But growing up, I remember, like, no.
No. When it's freezing and dark.
Yeah.
Freezing
doesn't get, just gray the whole day. Yeah.
Also, you're sleeping under, like, 15 blankets because, like.
Yeah. It's physically harder to get out of bed when you have, like.
You're in, like, a cave of blankets.
Yeah.
I took NyQuil last night, which I think I am addicted to now. after my flu that transitioned into a cold. I took NyQuil and melatonin and got. I woke myself up from sheer stress at 5 a.m. this morning then laid in bed, tried to read, looked at Twitter, looked at Instagram stories, thought about how mad I am at every single person in my life that I love. And then I got in my car and drove here in an hour-long traffic. You know, it's just like the day started bleak. And will continue.
I mean, like Grace mentioned earlier, there's a difference between being sad and like having a downswing and being like clinically depressed. And I don't want, like, none of us are doctors. Mm-hmm. I just play one on a podcast. but for you individually, like, what is a moment when you would be like, okay, time for me to go to the doctor? Like, if you were feeling, like, mine is, like, if I were, like, if I'm crying uncontrollably for, like, an hour, I'm like, okay, this is, like, no reason crying. It's time. I need to, like, do something about that.
I think the point at which it interferes with the day-to-day, whether it's working, whether it's being able to get out of bed, and interactions with people that you loved and see on a consistent basis, all of which have happened to me. I mean, I've certainly been in therapy, and I'm looking forward to new WGA insurance kicking in January 1st, where I can get back. to my therapist. Thank you so much. I'm very excited about that. That's by the way, it should not be something that is, it should be very universal for people to be able to go see a therapist, but it's tough for people to get to the point where they feel like they can, or that they even want to. I mean, I know growing up in Texas, like, I didn't know anybody who was in therapy, anybody. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. And maybe that was a socioeconomic thing. Maybe that was a cultural thing. I don't know what it was, but nobody was in therapy. Mm-hmm. But now I'm at the point where even my mom, my older brothers, who were always like, what's therapy? That's for like weird rich kids on the Upper East Side and like television shows. They're like, oh, that's a thing that I should consider. That's a thing I would definitely embrace. And I like that. I feel like culturally, I have seen more people embracing therapy. But it's definitely up to an individual when you decide it's time. I don't know, maybe like planning a wedding is stressful enough to amp. I'm on the precipice of this. I feel like I should, you know, get into it.
I think for me, when I'm like, oh, it's gotten bad, is when I feel totally helpless and alone. And if I were to talk to someone I love and they'd be like, yeah, but I'm here for you. And I, you know, ask for help with XYZ. And I just like can't hear it. Then I'm like, I've gotten to a point where I can't even accept like love and help from people because I just can't even open up to it.
I just started Lexapro Wellbutrin combo about a month ago. And I've done that stuff in the past, but I hadn't been on it for a while. And I kind of got to a point where, and it was funny because it's the first time it happened, Andy came with me to the doctor. And initially I was like, I hate this. This feels infantilizing. But the decision was because I can't see the forest for the trees. So I can't go to this person and say, like, I was like, okay, you be here to say kind of from the outside, the person who sees me every day, but who doesn't have my sick brain, what you're actually experiencing of me. And then it was also, for me, I noticed, like, my thing is that I can't look people in the eye. I don't want to be out of the house. It's about like not having energy. And then that is coupled with, as you were saying, Grace, of like, how does it impede your life? I don't have a life that makes that possible. I can't be somebody who's literally 90% of my job is like being a dynamic person.
Yeah.
And like, if I can't do that at all, if the idea of like getting on stage, like I know there'll be times when I'm on stage and I look at the ground. That is how I know. I'm like, oh, you're not right. You can't even like look out.
Yeah.
And this is what your job is supposed to be. And that has happened. And then it's interesting though, because I would say the first week I took, I was like, Wellbutrin, honey, that's like fucking my meth. The first week I was like, let's clean the house. But now I'm like on week four and I find myself back to being tired again. And like, I missed the pep in my step it gave me that first week. But you know, it's always been the thing that's so important to know when it comes to that stuff. The thing that I don't want to accept sometimes is that, like, it's one of the many prongs, right, to fixing it. Like, I keep wanting, you know, because sometimes I'm like, okay, this is a chemical thing, so I'll have a little chemical adjustment and I'll be back. And then it's like, oh no, I still have to learn how to behave normally after that, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like figuring out like all those different layers of it. But yeah, I find for me, it tends to be about like having no energy and like being like, I can't be around people. Being around people hurts. Like when I'm like, it's too much work and they're going to want to talk. And then I have to look them in the eye and ask what they're doing.
And during the holidays, it's like most unavoidable.
You just don't even have,
I have a question. Did Andy, was he part of the decision making in terms of you deciding to go to the doctor?
No, I was like already in it, you know, and like certainly as a person who's like, because it is, you know, and being in a relationship and like realizing like, oh, what it is to be around somebody when they're hurting, right?
Yes.
It's like that's its own journey.
Yes.
And so, you know, after nearly a decade, I can't push that aside and say like, you need to relax. I am fine. And it's like, well, and so, no, it was more like, I was like, I think I need to go. But of course, I was like, I don't feel like it. You know, I didn't want to.
Mm-hmm. That's the bitch of it. Depression, the state of being depressed makes you less, and the more severe it is, the less likely you are to try to find help for it.
Yeah.
Such a bitch.
I know.
Homework, too.
It's
like, you got to go. I mean, I've met with therapists before, and I'm like, we just didn't click.
Like, it's like dating.
It is. And then it's like, you don't want to date when you're depressed, and it's an admission of a sickness.
Yeah.
And it's very, very, very hard to do. And if you even get to that point, you have made a giant victory that you do need to reward yourself for because it is so difficult.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like the times that I have had the energy to like talk to somebody, it's no longer a problem. It's like, the car. It's like when you take your car in to get it fixed and you're like, oh, it was making this sound. And like, it's not making the sound anymore, but it was making the sound. And
placebo effect.
Exactly. The act of doing something sometimes makes it better, but also it doesn't stop it from coming back.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like the times that I've been going to, that I've gone to therapy, I've had a very like ping pongy relationship with it. It'll be like, I'll go and I'll be like, that was fine. That was good. That was good. And I'll do it for like 6 weeks and I'll be like, I'm better now. And then I'll just stop. Then the same, it'll start over again. And it's like, I've never been medicated for depression, but I, you know, I have had like a Xanax prescription because it was like, it turns out it was just a bad relationship. And I was anxious. I was anxious all the time for like a legitimate, like I would go to the doctor. It's like, I can't sleep. I'm anxious all the time. It's like, well, you're scared of your boyfriend. That's that. And then actually the cure for that was just no longer being with him.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's hard because it's a condition where like there's sadness and there are things that you can do to alleviate deep sadness. Like go to the gym and walk on the treadmill for half an hour. That's like better than nothing. That's do something, do a single thing, do one load of laundry, go out to, walk down the block.
Don't you think that there are more incentives to not do things anymore in our day to day? Like, I think you're absolutely right. That is a prescription, but like we have fucking Netflix and Hulu Plus and Disney Plus now.
Reveling in your sadness does feel good.
Yeah. You know? And it's tough to get up against that. And to be like, I know I need to go do something, but also like Postmates is right there. And I can just order things. Like in some ways, the way that life has been automated for us, it's just not easy. It's just, life is just made so much easier to just
it's
sit.
It's easier to isolate.
Yeah. Yes, well, it's super easy.
And Megan, that's a really good point. It's okay to be sad sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, just because you're feeling sad doesn't mean you need to be like, no, I'm not. Everything's fine. And like, what is the line between... I'm asking, it's not a rhetorical question, I'm asking, what is for you the line between being like, okay, right now I am sad, I'm acknowledging that I'm feeling sad, I'm allowing myself to feel sad, and the time when you're like, okay, it's time for me to move on to a new feeling.
You know what helps is cues from friends and loved ones. That's tough, but, and I don't know if you guys have been in the place of having to, of recognizing it in a friend or recognizing it in a loved one and having to gently tell them, hey, you know, have you thought about therapy? Sometimes that is not met with a lot of resistance. Sometimes it's not met with positivity. That can be tough too, but listening to cues from people around you. Now, then again, I think it's an advantageous for people to be in to even have loved ones and close ones who can recognize those signs. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't necessarily have that and live in so much isolation that they don't have people who can recognize those signs for them. And that condition and that state for people is what I fear most, not only for myself, like God forbid that happens one day where I'm somehow living in isolation, but for people who are in society who just don't have those people looking out for those cues, then you really have to be self-sufficient, and that's tough.
I mean, I think what's really good right now is like this conversation feels very like normal. Mm-hmm. None of us are like, I really like all of you. You're all like very functional, successful people, but we all go through shit.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think a really important thing is for people to realize that it is so normal to have abnormal bouts of sadness.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And like one thing that I've noticed is a lot of art, a lot of pop culture right now is being made about sadness. Naomi, you've been on a podcast that's about depression. The hilarious
world of depression.
It's a great episode. And then I just watched Gary Gulman's The Great Depression, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then in Big Mouth, there's The Depression Kitty. What are some of your pieces, are your favorite pieces of like depression related art and culture? Because it's become so good. Like The Great Depression is incredible.
It's so funny to me, but it's also, there's something about, I'm very interested in who we allow to tell those stories and who we allow to be sad, because I've definitely felt like, because like some of my favorite, like I love like Maria Bamford. She talks a lot about that, Aparna Nancherla, and like that was kind of her thing. But I found in my own experience of talking about that stuff on stage, it doesn't land well. And I think it does have to do with, you know, what people see when they look at you and what they think of you and how that and how your different sadness manifests. Like, I think mine has it's an undercurrent of anger. And I'm a Black lady and I have like a deep, loud voice and I'm tall, and it's not the same as like someone who's like, it was so hard to be sad today. You know, where like you're instantly endeared to that person. Right. And then they like put a joke on it and you're like, I feel that, you know, or, and so it's interesting because I do feel like we are definitely talking about it more as a culture, but the people we kind of let tell the stories at a big level are like feeling a little samey to me.
Well, I think what's interesting too is the idea of there being performative depression or performative sadness. Not to say that people put it on, but you know, like those Instagram pictures of people will take of themselves, like, you know, it's ultimately like an attractive selfie, but they're like, I had a terrible day today and everything's so bad. And it's like, I'm not saying you're not sad or depressed, but like you're putting this on for your followers. You need likes. You feel that desire to get approval for what you're feeling. And that to me is a really tricky area. I think great art can be made and should be made from and has been made historically through you know, with these sentiments in mind. But I also think that there's I think a trend, especially with social media, where we're moving towards people performing out their sadness because they desire that attention, even if it's not necessarily genuine.
Yeah.
I agree 100% with, well, everyone, with what you're saying sort of about like the messenger that's allowed. I also think that, you know, we live on a coast and we are in a creative business where our emotions and the things we're going through are very much celebrated, but to be, you know, at your insurance job and walk in and be like, I'm depressed, and just like throwing darts at a picture of yourself is probably frowned upon.
Yeah. And I think that's hilarious.
More you people get a raise. Yeah. Exactly.
But so it's like, we almost are the luckiest because we're allowed to have this conversation and no one thinks it's weird or crazy.
You can also monetize your breakdown.
Absolutely.
You know? Like that's a special deal.
Yeah. I've talked about, oh my God, I remember once talking about how they found a lump and I was just like, I guess I have to do stand-up. and everyone was like, not furious, but I could, and I start crying on stage, which is like the most vulnerable, terrible thing you can do. And I was just like, no, I deserve this. Like, I've given so much. I'm going to fucking cry up here on this stage. But people were like, we just want to hear about like boats and like how much you want to fuck your family. Not this.
Okay, literally. So a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, a close family friend died. It was very sudden. She was very young. It was a very, very bad. And I did a show that week, and it was one of those things where it's like, of course I could have canceled, but I was like needing, like I had done it. Either way, the point being, I literally got on stage, but it was that thing where I was like, I don't want to do this right now. This feels terrible. I was like, I wish we were in one of those movies where like a stand-up has a breakdown on stage and then everyone gets up and slow claps and they win the big audition. Because there is always that like trope, you know, where it's like, you got a big audition, then they like fuck it up because they're too upset. And then everyone's like, we love you anyway. Yeah. Like, that was real.
That vulnerability.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, in real life, absolutely not. Like, no one wants to sit there and, like,
I'm
walk.
Charles yep. W. Comedy, yeah. the yeah. president of comedy, and I'm making you my vice president.
Exactly.
Yeah. The big Sick has a very right. that, funny that, scene yes. where he's doing, like, his JFL audition and has this right breakdown, and he bombs. Yeah. Because that's usually what happens. Yeah. Yep. But it's like, we're allowed to bomb. That's a part of our process, too.
But it does feel like there has been, and a big thing I attribute it to is Marc Maron, you know, grandfather of podcasts, but also grandfather of the comedy as catharsis, where suddenly I feel like in the last 10 years, there's been this shift to like being real as opposed to like this distance observation. Mm-hmm. I think now it's like, this is my real. And then the other flip side of that is then like, you know, just like ironic, detached nonsense.
Yeah.
This is not a treatise on comedy. Let me focus and tell you why I'm talking about this. Because it feels like part of that change is people craving that realness. Like, I think we as a society, kind of going back to recent, this isolation, it feels like you just want people to, like, be real around you and, like, you want to feel connected and tethered. Mm-hmm. And in a world where we could literally sit on our computers and do everything, to hear somebody say anything about, like, what they're really feeling is like, oh, God, please and thank you.
Yeah,
please and thank you, because I'm in my room thinking I'm crazy, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. But I also think, calling back to what Grace was saying, is like when we talk about our own struggles with, you know, feeling sad or having it veer into depression or anxiety or whatever, I think that like I have to ask myself, like, what is curated and what is real? I think what's helpful is to be like real, is to just be like, okay, this is really what I'm feeling. And I guess I'm not doing it for the likes. I'm just saying it because it's what I'm feeling and maybe it'll be useful for somebody and they don't even have to like, you know what I mean? It's, it's kind of this weird, like, trick mirror Gia Tolentino style, like, spiral of, like, what's real, what's not real, what am I portraying, what is actually happening? Mm-hmm. But I do want to, we have to close this conversation. It was great, but we have to get to the hills this week. I want to go around the table and everybody offer some generic words of encouragement to anybody who might be listening, who might be feeling a little bit, you know, sad or going through some depression.
Well, thank you so much for listening. You are doing awesome. We are really appreciative of you, and this will pass. It will pass. There are ebbs and flows in life. And, you know, I hate the, God, there's so much terrible advice out there. So just try not to listen to any advice. Just try to get through it. But one step in front, you know, one foot in front of the other. You're loved. You are definitely loved.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Megan?
I think sometimes just having a good cry, you come out on the other side and feel a sense of relief. Mm-hmm. And if that means you got to go into the bathroom at a Vegas casino, like I did recently, I did feel better. And I think it's a good sign, too, if you have a good cry and you don't come out of it feeling better, that, you know, maybe it's time to try and seek some help that is around you and I hope readily available. And, you know, just find one person.
Yeah. Make a list of three things to do today. I don't care how big or how small. Literally one of them can be shower. A lot of times for me it is. Mm-hmm. One of the three should be something for someone or something else. Sometimes for me that is just walking my dog. And just do those three things today. And literally they can be so small, like washing the dishes or folding the laundry that you might have washed a week ago. Do those three things. You will be fine. And when you do them, you will know, like, oh, I can do anything.
That's very good advice. So my generic words of encouragement are, if you're feeling sad, sit back and ask yourself what makes you happy. Even if you can't do those things right now, the fact that they exist, you can hold on to them.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
And think about them. Like, here's something that makes me happy. It's real dumb. Broccoli, rice, and Velveeta cheese mixed together.
Oh, that's like, great.
Yeah, like, just think of those things. You know, pull a Julie Andrews, like Maria Von Trapp. These are a few of my favorite things. Listen them to yourself. What's your favorite dumbass movie that you only watch when you're by yourself? Just think of it. Mm-hmm. Think about a song you really love. Think about a food you really like. Think about a person whose face you like looking at. You know, think about those things that you like. And you know, your feeling of sadness won't necessarily immediately go away. But remember, there are things that you really do love in the world, even if you hate this second, even if you hate today. Mm-hmm. So we solved depression.
We did it.
We did it. Thank you, guys. We have to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with the hills that we'll die on. Okay, we're back. This is a part of the show where we get real petty. It's The Hills We'll Die On. Let's get started with our listener hill.
Hi, hysteria ladies. The hill I will die on is that you should never sit down at a restaurant and be given a menu for dinner without also getting the dessert menu. How do I know if I want to have an appetizer and an entree if I don't know if there's something good to have for dessert as well? Do I need to plan to go elsewhere for dessert? I need to make these decisions from the get-go. So please, let me see everything you have on offer so I can plan my meal. Don't make me wait and either be disappointed that you have shitty desserts or have eaten too much to have a great sounding dessert.
Love that.
This is my sister. This is my Australian soul sister. Because I am like that. I will legit go and be like, I need to know what I'm working towards. That's what I'll say to the waiter. I need to know. I need to see it. Because yes, I might have a smaller little entree. I wouldn't have a pasta-based entree if I know there's a brownie sundae in my future. This is my sister. I agree.
Yeah. Yep. That's a hard agree. Also, I love the way that Australians talk. I have a friend here in LA who is,
do not like
him. I love it. I'm like an accent queen. I love accents. I'm fascinated by them. And I love the Australian accent. I think they're great. And I love that she said on offer. Like how when they say look after, I was going to look after the person, like their house plants or whatever. Anyway, Australians are great. Para, what's your hill this week?
Well, harkening back to something that Megan said about how this is a season where we're all just stuffing our faces full of disgusting bullshit. The hill that I'm going to die on is along the same lines, talking about food, talking about preparation of food, talking about hygiene. Y'all need to wash your hands more. Yeah. And I say this because I recently contracted some shit. And I tried on wedding dresses this past Saturday. Ooh. I woke up in the morning with a rumbly tummy, and I got through the wedding dress situation. Okay, I almost had a bridesmaid moment, but I had 3 minutes to spare.
Oh my God.
Got home and then unleashed the wrath of God on poor Beechwood Canyon. And I don't know what it was. It was not food because nobody else got it, and I ate the same things that everybody else did, but it was some bug situation. Mm. And I know somebody out there with the filthy little hands put it on to either a dress that I was trying, and it was real bad. And I just don't think that we are hygienic enough. And you know what? I say that as somebody who could up her hand washing game. So hill I'll die
on. That's incredible.
Wash your hands.
Yeah, right. That's right. Good. Literally, people will die on that hill if you do not wash your hands. You could get diseases.
Yes.
Well, Grace had to leave because she's busy. So I'll go next and we will all shit on Grace. The hill that I'll die on this week is... we have to stop with the weather inflation. And by that, I mean like the hysterics around every single weather event. When I was a kid, we didn't have a fucking bomb cyclone. we didn't name our winter storms Wilbur or Bernadette or whatever. No. We didn't have like these super triple dark black hurricane, you know, hurricane rains. It's like, I get that extreme weather is happening. Mm-hmm. I get that climate change is real. But, like, let's, like, dial back
the selling of weather. I just think it's too much and people freak out and just say it's going to snow. Snowing, snowing is itself. I get it. You don't need to like add all these extra words.
Well, because the thing is, you think you're not going to have to go and do anything. So you you get like snow day brain and be like, well, everything's going to be canceled tomorrow. And then nothing happens. And you're like, yeah, but I was planning to not do anything. And now I have to do something. And this is the weather person's fault.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think it's better to under-promise and over-deliver, though, than to
over-promise.
But
you have to be prepared. I think the problem is because not enough people believe in climate change. We have to like try to scare them. Uh-huh. But I hear what you're saying. Because trust me, when I heard the phrase bomb cyclone, I said, I'm going to need you to relax. Because what can you do about that, right?
Yeah.
But then also, too, just now, the storm that was just on the East Coast, it was called Winter Storm Ezekiel, which I thought was, like, way too much, I think, as far as storm names go.
Don't give them a Children of the Corn name.
Thank you. I was like, okay, literally coming for us all, Ezekiel. And so that like, that is, like... I mean, I'm with you. Like, I don't like naming storms in general. I think you can just say the date the storm took place. Do you know what I mean? You could say like the November 10th, 2019 storm. We don't need a name.
Yeah.
I like when they go alphabetical, though. Like with, you know, with hurricanes, they're like Tropical Storm Agnes. And then you're like, what's going to be B? Like when there's something when you can like guess, I do like
See,
that.
See, this is why I didn't think you had depression. Because you're really finding joy in the little things.
I do find
you're
joy in the little things. It's what keeps me going.
But just alphabetize. You know what? Next time you're feeling bad, just alphabetize something. Okay. Megan, you want to go next?
Yes. Gosh, people really come for me on my hills.
Really? Do they?
Yes. I almost clapped back at someone the other week, and then I was like, don't do it. I know. Because okay. So this one, if you can't get behind this, I just don't know what to do. I know I'm going to get shit about the Australian thing. Sweaters should be soft. They are itchy more than they are soft. Uh-huh. And so many times, I had a sweater on today that was very cute, and then I took it off because I was like, I'm going to have to be in this for like 7 hours. Mm-hmm. And it was so itchy, and it was expensive. Mm-hmm. So if something is expensive, it should be soft. It should not be that itchy. I don't care how chic it looks. I have one itchy sweater that I'll never get rid of that my dead grandmother made, and she was doing the best she could.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it's like Bloomingdale's, find better fabric. I want it to be soft on my skin.
Yes, mm-hmm. I agree. You know what? I was also thinking about a sweater I just bought from H&M. I think sweaters should be warm, but also breathable. Like this is a sweater where like the moment I come inside, I'm sweating. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like it's just, and I'm like, but it's not like very thick.
No.
It's got to be breathable.
Breathable and soft.
Soft and breathable.
That's all we want. Yeah.
I mean, cashmere is a little bit of a scam in a lot of cases. Really? If you get like a, the itchy thing is like.
If I touch cashmere and it's itchy, I want that store to go bankrupt.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. Soft sweaters. Got to do it. Naomi. Bring us home.
Well, okay, something simple. You know, as you could tell by my excitement over the menu hill, my hill is food related, okay? We've just come off of Thanksgiving. And you guys, why aren't we eating stuffing year round? Because I'm telling you, I have it once a damn year. And then I go, where the hell has it been? Mm-hmm. And then so many people were like, well, in England, we have stuffing all the time. Okay, America, where you at with the fucking stuffing? I was like, literally like fucking savory bread, bitch. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sage. Mm. What are we? I get stuffing once a year. It's literally all I look forward to for Thanksgiving is stuffing. We went to a friend's house. You know, it was like a potluck thing. And literally I was like, are you going to finish all that stuffing? Literally, they gave me a tray of stuffing to take home. Ate it over 4 days. And granted, 4 days of stuffing, you're going to have some difficulty pooping. But the flavor's undeniable. We need to be having stuffing year-round. It needs to be an option. I need to be able to go to restaurants and have stuffing. And there should be all types. You know, a cornbread, a bread. You know, maybe you want to do a meat, but it should always be vegetarian. A range of gravies. I just feel like we're not having stuffing as much as we could be having stuffing. It's not complicated to make.
You could open a gourmet stuffing restaurant.
I thought about it.
Like a gelato counter where it's just stuffing.
It's called, I got it. It's called That's the Stuff. And you get a range of stuffings, range of gravies. And then a couple of kind of cranberry toppings. And if you've got a stuffing that has a little meat in it, then well, that's your full meal. That's your full meal. But you're getting a range of stuffings. I'm already on top of that. Consider this a copyright.
You know, when I was living in Chicago, there was a place called the Meatloaf Bakery.
I was just going to bring this up. And I would pass it and I go, I got to go there because I do love meatloaf.
Oh my God.
And I never went and I'm like, and it shut down.
Yes, it did.
Oh no.
Megan, I was dating a guy who lived a block from the Meatloaf Bakery.
Wow.
And it's like meatloaf in the shape of a cupcake. And on top of it, they put little mashed potatoes and cheese and stuff.
Oh, my God. A full meal cupcake. Savory cupcake.
It was a meat cupcake.
And it was inexpensive real estate.
Yeah.
It was on a prime street.
It was on like Clark Street.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Was it busy? Were people there?
No, that's why it closed down.
Yes, and they paid. Yeah,
that's
not getting enough.
But I think that's the stuff has some hope.
Yep, thank you.
It can occupy the Meatloaf Bakery. No, do it in Chicago. That's a food town.
Yeah.
People would
indulge.
It's
cold a lot.
Yeah.
You need that stuff.
People would have a whole that's the stuff type
Shark
situation.
Tank.
We gotta go in Shark Tank.
Yeah.
That's oh my stuff. God. That's the stuff. Naomi, Megan, and Grace, thank you so much for coming by today. Thanks to Alyssa Mastromonaco and Elise Hoag for talking about the news. And there'll be more Hysteria next week. Hysteria is a product of Crooked Media. Caroline Reston is our producer. Our editor is Sarah Barrett, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thank you to Juliet Beckstrand for production support and to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Nadina Melkonian for filming and editing our video content every week. Give them what they want.